From Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. This week, Oscar-nominated writer Randall Wallace reflects on his iconic and Academy Award-winning film, Braveheart.
I would have young writers say to me, I've written 3 drafts and I'm just despairing. And I kind of like to say the truth. I wrote 12 drafts before I ever showed it to anyone.
Followed by screenwriter Jeb Stuart, who dissects the screenplay for his classic thriller, The Fugitive.
If you've worked in the business long enough, you can see that Variety or the Hollywood Reporter headline, which is, tragedy strikes Hollywood. And somewhere in one of the little sidebar articles, it says, Stuart never works again.
On Story will be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Randall Wallace is the Oscar-nominated creative force behind many box office hits, such as Braveheart, We Were Soldiers, Pearl Harbor, Secretariat, and Man in the Iron Mask. After drawing the interest of director and star Mel Gibson, Braveheart became Wallace's first produced screenplay and ended up the film's success story of 1995, winning the Academy Award for Best Picture and also for Best Director. I spoke with Wallace at a retrospective screening of the film at the 21st Annual Austin Film Festival in 2014. Clips from this episode, copyright BH Finance CV, Icon Productions, and Ladd Company.
I shall tell you of William Wallace. Historians from England will say I am a liar, but history is written by those who have hanged heroes. The King of Scotland had died without a son, and the King of England, a cruel pagan known as Edward the Long Shanks, claimed the throne of Scotland for himself. Scotland's nobles fought him and fought each other over the crown.
Wow. I hadn't seen it on a big screen in a long time. That's an incredibly powerful film. I mean, I guess the first big question is, could you sum up not just how you wrote the story, but what the themes of that story are ultimately to you?
I think about the choice that Robert the Bruce has to make. The idea of, do I listen to the logic of the world or do I follow this other thing? That to me is the essence of the story. Do I surrender to the wisdom of people who are advising me to give up on what seems to me the truest thing, or do I hold to that no matter what?
This Wallace, he doesn't even have a knighthood, but he fights with passion and he inspires.
And you wish to charge off and fight as he did, eh? So would I, eh?
Well, maybe it's time.
It is time to survive. You're the 17th Robert Bruce. There's 16 before you passed you land and title because they didn't charge in. Call a meeting of the nobles.
But they do nothing but talk.
Rightly so. They're as rich in English titles and lands as they are in Scottish, just as we are. You admire this man, this William Wallace. Uncompromising men are easier to admire. His courage, so does a dog. But it is exactly the ability to compromise that makes a man noble.
That's the point of the spear of the story. I was married and my wife had Mormon ancestors and knew all the history of her family, and I didn't know any of the history of mine. So when we got pregnant with our first son, I wanted to find out who my family was and went to Scotland and saw a statue of William Wallace next to a statue of Robert the Bruce and started asking questions. And that's where I picked up the trail of the story. And I've always believed that I'm a blood relative of William Wallace. You know, what is a blood relative? You know, if you go back far enough, we're all related. We're all brothers of William Wallace, and we're all brothers of Judas Iscariot. We're all brothers of the best and the worst. In a certain way, for me, every character in there, you know, it's like I couldn't write it unless I understood it myself. And I wish at times that I was more William Wallace, but personally, I'm probably more Robert the Bruce. I calculate more. And if I didn't, I wouldn't know how to write that. I wouldn't know how to say what Robert the Bruce's father says to him. You know, he has courage. So does a dog. You want for your family to be okay. I've had those conversations with myself. That voice is in me, just like the voice that says, they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom. That one's in me too. I think one of the reasons the movie works is that this movie here plays out inside the lives of each of us. We each have those conversations, I think. I write in stages. I just write, and then I rewrite, and then I rewrite it. I would have young writers say to me, I've written 3 drafts, and I'm just despairing because the story is not working. And I kind of like to say the truth. I wrote 12 drafts of this before I ever showed it to anyone and said, here's my first draft. Like I was saying, I see things differently, and it struck me how deeply my mother was in this story, and that in a certain way that she was Murren for me, that he had kept that flower, and that when he gave it to her, he knew what the message was. The message to her, the revelation to her, as she realizes, oh, he's given me a thistle. He's given me, oh my God, that's the thistle I gave him. He's kept it his whole life. The power of a woman's love for a man, that's why he wanted freedom. The situation was that a more powerful man, a richer man, a nobler man, could take the women of his friends on their wedding day and treat love that way. You know, you tell them that Scotland's sons and daughters are yours no more as long as I live. And I understood the power of love in that.
Come to claim the right of Prima Nocta. As lord of these lands, I will bless this marriage by taking the bride into my bed on the first night of her union.
Oh, by God, you will not!
It is my noble right.
I think it struck me tonight, actually, watching it, that was an incredible amount of loyalty that he had, not just towards her, but towards this way of life. And that scene of betrayal with Robert Bruce was, I think, all the more powerful in seeing that. Some of this has to do with like what you wrote and what Mel Gibson then envisioned and directed. Was that scene in your head like that? The betrayal scene with Robert the Bruce, when Wallace finds him under the mask, you know?
Well, yeah, absolutely. It's exactly what I wrote, and the beats were as I wrote it. But the way he portrayed his heartbreak was very much Mel. The look in his face, the lying down, you know, that was that actor and those actors doing it that way. I watched this with incredible gratitude for him and admiration for how alive he made it. And do I have pride watching it? Yeah, I think it's so strange to me, because you'd like to say, see, this is validation. But the weird part is that there were plenty of times that I would look at the movie and go, this doesn't work. So it's not like, you know, I was always sure. And I had friends that I had been working with in television for many years, and I had left television. I was basically booted out of television. I couldn't get a job. I couldn't get a meeting. The next thing my friends hear from me is, I've got this movie called Braveheart, and we're at a theater at Paramount Studios, and it's like 1,500 people, and we're all sitting there in the movie, and it was this cut. It was the final cut with all the music we're showing. And I'm sitting there, and I was squirming through the whole movie going, oh, it's too long, it's too violent, it's over the top, it's overwritten, really, I was just dying. And the movie was over, and I looked where my friends were, and they were gone. And I went, oh, thank heaven, I understand, they don't want to tell me how much it sucks. I go walking out, and everybody was kind of silent walking out of the theater, and I thought, oh, they hated it, they were just bored to tears. And my two friends who didn't know each other were coming out of the men's room, and I ran into them, and I went, I know. I'm so sorry. You know, it's too long. It's too violent. I know. And they went, what are you talking about? We've been in there crying. We don't want anybody to see us. And it's like, your fears, I'm just as vulnerable to it as anyone else is. If you're listening to your fear, you don't see the truth.
Okay, on another lighter note about the scenes you envisioned, the mooning sequence, who can forget that? Was that historically accurate?
You know, who knows? It was so natural and appropriate. We think it was. And I'll tell you what was scripted. The mooning was scripted. The frontal was not. And the Scots wanted to do it. And they were Irish, mostly those guys. And so that sort of derived from the old story about, you know, people always ask, what do you wear under your kilt? And it's literally required that you not wear anything under your kilt. They'll tell you that. I took a son to Scotland, and he wore his first kilt. And the Highlanders said, you wear a kilt a certain way. You do not have to wear the kilt. But if you wear it, you have to wear it right. Following along in that was how the whole, hey, why don't they moon them? I thought of that a long time ago, and it was cool. I liked it.
Well, I know what your opinion about research and over-research is, but Longshanks was a fascinating character and seductive in a way in here, and how much of him was actually based on the real king and how much was just you?
I don't like to just like, it's all me, but it was me. I didn't know anything about Edward I, except that he was a powerful king, well-loved in England, thought of as one of England's greatest kings, and his nickname besides Longshanks was Hammer of the Scots.
Edward Longshanks is the most ruthless king ever to sit on the throne of England. And none of us and nothing of Scotland will remain unless we are as ruthless. Give ear to our nobles. Knowing their minds is the key to the throne.
For more On Story, check your local PBS station for our television show of the same name. Every episode is a surprising and intimate look at filmmaking. Check your local listings, stream from PBS, or go to onstory.tv. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry-standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. We're back with Braveheart screenwriter Randall Wallace discussing his film, which was inspired by a family trip to Scotland. In our next segment, Wallace takes us more deeply into the journey of getting the script from the page to the screen.
I discovered something years later, and those of you who have been to London, there's a street called Charing Cross Road. And where that word comes from is that he loved his wife dearly, and she died while he was campaigning against the Welsh, who were also Celts, like the Scots and the Irish. And he ordered her body carried back to London on the shoulders of his men and ordered that wherever they set her body down to rest, they would erect a cross. And they would call that a Cher Rien cross, which meant darling queen. I also knew Edward, I didn't make it up, Edward II was thought to be homosexual and was executed in a horrific way pertaining to that. And he was despised. And I don't think despised because he was homosexual. I think he was despised because he was a weak king. His wife, the daughter of Philip II, called Philip the Fair. When Edward I died, when Longshanks died, she returned to France, raised an army, and came back and deposed him. So I knew those things. She was also, by the way, 7 years old when William Wallace was executed. So it was not her in the story. The actual legends of the Scots were that it was Longshanks' wife, the Cher Rhiann wife.
I will love you my whole life. You and no other.
And I you. You and no other forever.
Well, I think of this film as much as a love story as I do as an action film. And that thread that runs through here, that piece of cloth that he carries, can you talk a little bit about how that whole process started in the script and how it became what it became?
Yeah, and I every time I talk about Braveheart, I always want to talk about Rebecca Pollock, Sidney Pollock's daughter, who got every bit of his talent and brilliance. Becky was the vice president of development at MGM. I had written a script called Love and Honor, which I've tried my whole life to get made. Haven't yet, but I still believe I will. And she had seen that script, and when she read it, she said, I want his next two scripts sight unseen. And we made a deal, and those next two scripts were Braveheart and Man in the Iron Mask. She read the script, and she called me up and said, I've never seen this happen. They gave a copy to my assistant, and she was sobbing. And when we distributed it, every secretary in the building was crying. And I would walk by and go, oh, you're reading Braveheart, right? She said, I've never seen that happen. Well, you know what that does to you as a writer, you know, when you hear that? And she went, I would love to see if there was something. And she said, I know it's kind of corny, but just something that she gave him that he could keep that it. And I went, wow, that feels like a great thing. And I had known from some of the Scots I knew that when they wed, they didn't exchange rings. They would bind their hands together. And I thought, what a beautiful thing to keep. And that was Becky's idea. And it was beautiful. Another thing I have to say, it's extraordinary to me now, but I wrote Robert the Bruce, and then the script was so long, I cut him out. And in the first draft, she called and said, I absolutely love it. I just love it. It moves me, and told me all the different ways that she loved it. And she said, you know, when you first told me the story, you mentioned this Robert the Bruce guy, and he seemed like an important character. And I said, yeah, but William Wallace, it's about William Wallace. Robert the Bruce isn't really important. And she went, yeah, I know, but, you know, I would really love it if you just try to see if he worked again. Just, it wasn't put it back in. It was just take a look. And then when I looked again, I went, wow, that's right. I mean, you know, there's the story of Tennessee Williams, whose most famous line is, I've always depended on the kindness of strangers. And he read it to a friend. He was doing rewrites, and he cut it out. And the friend went, where's that line about the kindness of strangers? And Tennessee Williams went, ah, that's pretentious. It's dumb and dumb. This friend went, no, you need it. And it is important. We're all vulnerable sometimes, and we need the right person at the right time to say, no. I believe Jesus of Nazareth prayed sincerely, I don't want to do this. I believe he sincerely meant, my God, why have you forsaken me? The fact that we are human and that we do break is not the ultimate failure. The ultimate failure is if we don't keep wanting and hoping, and we need each other in those times. This wasn't a heroic enterprise of mine. It was that the right people at the right time loved me in the right way. The simplest thing that I could say about the way it spoke to Mel, and then Mel spoke and who Mel is spoke through it. I'm Christian, so is Mel. We're different sorts of Christians in that he's a traditional Catholic and I am a Baptist. You know, on the poles of things, you would think we would be really different. But he completely got the story, and that the story had to be this man's willingness to die, and that he did die, the sacredness of the friendships. He completely got it. I mean, and I knew when I let it go, I mean, I knew when we started to send it out, that the normal Hollywood thing would be, well, we can't have a downer ending. His friends have to swing in on vines and give him a sword, and he'll stick the executioner in the eye, and we'll... I mean, there were people who had wanted to do that. My experience as a writer said the story will begin when William Wallace returns home, and all this childhood story won't be there because, you know, it would make the movie 2.5 hours long, and you're not going to have 30 minutes when you don't even see the star. I wasn't thinking it would be Mel Gibson at the time I wrote it, but you wouldn't have Mel Gibson in a movie and that he doesn't show up for 30 minutes and all that. That was what my craft, my intellect was saying, but I was afraid to write the story. I'd been afraid for a long time, so I thought, I'll just write his childhood as a way to warm up. And the first day, the first page was, I will tell you of William Wallace, historians from England will say I'm a liar, but history is written by those who've hanged the heroes. That just came out, and I went, oh, that's pretty good. I had thought about the hanging barn where the Scots were all executed, and I thought that would be later, but I thought, well, I'll just write that now. And the whole thing about the flower and the, I didn't know that was going to happen. His parents are dead. He's there alone at the graveside. It was unbearable for me as I wrote it. I didn't have an outline. The story was just unfolding, and I thought, gosh, this is miserable. Surely somebody would comfort this boy. Who would it be? And I thought, well, it would be a child. So then I have a girl, and I think, what would she do? Well, she'd pick a flower. And I didn't know he kept it until I reached the scene where he takes her for a ride and he wants to kiss her, but he can't bring himself to. And then she's going to go inside, and I'm sitting there writing it, and I'm thinking, he's got to do something. Well, maybe he gives her something. What would he give her? And he grabs her hand and he gives her something. And I didn't know then that, and then she opens it up and it's the flower. The story just hit me. The biggest one was in the execution. And the axe is falling toward his head. I can see the room where I was. I can feel it. Axe is falling. I'm going, well, we can't show the axe hit his throat. So what will we see? And I thought, we should go now to what he sees. What in the last moments of his life would he look at? Does he look to the sky? What does he see? And I thought, no, he would know that his friends were there. So I wrote, in the last moment of his life, William Wallace turns his eyes towards his friends, Hamish and Stephen. And it was not until that instant that I knew that she was there. And I wrote, and moving between them is her. And I sat there and I wept. And when I see it now, it's like it just kills me. It feels like it's me. It feels like it's utterly me, but it doesn't feel like it's mine. It doesn't feel like I made it up. It just feels like it told itself to me, through me. I completely believe that.
Screenwriter Randall Wallace discussing his 1995 classic film Braveheart at the 2014 Austin Film Festival. You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Jeb Stuart is the writer, producer, responsible for the screenplays of several blockbuster films, including Die Hard, The Fugitive, Fire Down Below, Another 48 Hours, and Switchback, which he also directed. The Fugitive, directed by Andrew Davis and starring Tommy Lee Jones and Harrison Ford, is the only remake of a regular television show to be nominated for Best Picture at the Academy Awards. The film's accolades include an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor for Tommy Lee Jones, and nominations for Best Cinematography, Best Sound Mixing, Best Film Editing, Best Effects, and Best Original Score. Jeb spoke with No Film School contributor Christopher Boone at the 22nd Annual Austin Film Festival in 2015. Clips from this episode copyright Warner Brothers, a division of Time Warner Entertainment Company, LP.
The Fugitive had been an idea at Warner Brothers, and it had been a commissioned script for quite a few years. Someone once told me it had been around for like 10 years before I came onto it. A lot of really good writers. Walter Hill had done a draft, Larry Gross, you know, Robert Kamen. I love the idea. No one was attached to it. There was no director, no star. But the two things that I said that I really would need to have happen was I felt like it ought to be just, I didn't want to set it up just to be a sequel, which of course is what Warner Brothers wanted, is, you know, Fugitive 1, Fugitive 2. The other idea is I said, you know, I feel like Richard Kimball on the TV show, you could have the circumstantial evidence that he didn't love his wife, but in a movie, he needed to love his wife. You know, the whole idea is that you couldn't have a guy running away from the electric chair. You had to have a guy proving he didn't kill his wife. And they didn't like that idea either. So anyway, two or three months later, I get this call from my agent who said, you're doing The Fugitive. They love your ideas. And I went into the kitchen and I said to my wife, I said, you know, I have really arrived in Hollywood. You know, Warner Brothers, you know, bowed down to Jeb Stuart. And she picks up the USA Today. We were on vacation, I guess. And it says, Harrison Ford agrees to do The Fugitive. Two things. He has to love his wife. And he only is going to do this one movie. I really had, you know, I realized immediately that they just remember, who was that guy who wanted these two things? So anyway, I came on at that point. That's how I came on to the project. I flew into LA to meet with Warner Brothers to sort of begin the talking process. This was in October. And when I got there, I was met at the gate. That was in the days when you could be met at the gate by a driver. And he said, Warner Brothers wants to know what sizes of tennis clothes that you need. And the tensions on the rackets that you will require. But they said, apparently, Mr. Ford has a tennis court in Jackson Hole, and he found out that before I had gone to graduate school, I had been a tennis pro. Anyway, we drove over to Van Nuys. My rackets, you know, were there. The clothes were there. The Warner Brothers executives were there. And what I found out that USA Today had completely lied. Harrison Ford had not signed on to do The Fugitive. It was one of three different projects he was thinking about. Fortunately, I'd read an article on the paper in the Wall Street Journal on the flight from New York to LA, and it was about pharmaceutical fraud. And I thought, this is going to be my story, you know? And I landed, and we went there, and we literally went right to the ranch, and Harrison came in, and he was wonderful, and he said, this is great. Now, all the suits sitting behind, and I'm sitting there, and he says, tell me, what's The Fugitive? And that began with probably one of the most brutal pitches I have ever made in my entire life. And I'm spinning. And you can see Harrison's face is kind of like, wow, you know, this is dying. And so suddenly he said, well, let's take a break. Did you bring your tennis clothes? And I did, you know. And so we went out, and now his court sits at about 7,200 feet or so. So you can imagine how everything is a little lighter at the elevation. I taught tennis for years. I can hit a ball back to the middle of the court like nobody's business. I mean, it's like when you have to make a living hitting to middle-aged housewives and businessmen who suddenly took it up, you know, late in life, you can do a lot. So I'm hitting and thinking, what am I doing wrong? How am I? And finally, he comes to the net and he says, I thought you were a really good, you know, tennis player. I mean, you know, if I want a lesson, I'll go hire somebody. And I realized, I learned something very clear about Harrison. He's a terrific guy. He is the ultimate trash talker. So we play a game, and I, you know, I keep the ball in play and that sort of thing. And after about two games, he came up to me and he said, God, you're terrible. I mean, you know, you're unbelievable. You know, I thought I would be having to struggle here, and I'm really, and Harrison, by the way, is a pretty good tennis player. And so I went back and I thought, well, this mother is going to get, you know, I bet he's never seen a twist serve in his life. So I got back, it was my turn to serve. So I hit this incredible, you know, Australian twist. It comes in, you know, just like a lamb. And then when it hits, it just at elevation, it just goes, woo, like that, you know. And he swung at it and missed and hit the bridge of his nose. And he went down like I had shot him. And I, if you've lived and if you've worked in the business long enough, you can see that Variety or the Hollywood Reporter headline, which is, you know, tragedy strikes Hollywood. And somewhere in one of the little sidebar articles, it says, Stewart never works again. So I ran up to the net and he stood up and he's pinching this thing together. And the first thing I noticed is his shirt is just, I mean, just bloody. I said, man, you know, you got to get to the hospital. We got to put, you got to have some stitches. And he said, no, we're going to go over to the carpentry shop. He's got this, you know, he's a Rocky Mountain carpenter. So we'll go over to the shop and I'll get a bandage out of the first aid kit. And I'm thinking, this is ridiculous. So anyway, we walk over there and we go into the carpentry shop. And there were a bunch of these big, burly Rocky Mountain carpenters in there. And they look at, you know, Harrison, and they goes, oh, God, boss, you got to go to the hospital. You know, and they're just saying what I was saying. He said, no. Pops open the first aid kit. He gets a little butterfly bandage and he pops it up there. He closes it up. And he says, well, look at the time. We better go back. And he said, you know, when we go back, just do your pitch. And we're not going to say anything about this. And I'm like, how could we not say anything about this? I mean, if you've ever seen anybody who's lost a lot of blood in their head, you know, your eyes, you have these great big circles under. And he looked like I had just beaten him up with a rack. So anyway, we walk back. We go in. He goes into the kitchen. The guys sit back and everybody's like, you know, this is the president of production and two VPs, and everybody's like, how'd it go? Did you screw it up? You know, did you try to patch it up? And I said, well, we talked a little bit, but it was kind of rugged out there. And they were like, oh, no, don't tell me that. How bad could it be? Out of the kitchen comes Harrison with some lemonade or something, and he says, yeah, well, we, you know, listen, let's get this over with. And I'm there thinking, oh, my God, we've just lost to Paramount. Anyway, he sits down. I struggled through a little bit more of the pitch. And he says, great, I'm in. I love it. And they're like, oh, my God, they can't figure it out. Nobody says anything about his nose, which is what Harrison knew. Nobody was going to say, oh, my God, what happened to you? They're so worried about the fugitive. Anyway, it wasn't until later we're driving into town to get some, you know, lunch, and we're all piled into a big Suburban, and he's driving in. You know, his wife is, you know, was coming back this way with their two children, and children roll down their window and they said, oh my God, what happened to you? And I remember Harrison having this incredible smile on his face, and he turned around and looked at all the executives in the back and said, those children are really great children. They care about what happens to me. Anyway, it began a very good working relationship with Harrison.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. We'll be back in a moment. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with fugitive screenwriter Jeb Stewart speaking with Christopher Boone at the 2015 Austin Film Festival. In our next segment, Stewart discusses the influence of North by Northwest screenwriter Ernest Lehman on his film. And working with Tommy Lee Jones, who went on to win the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for his role in The Fugitive.
When I was in graduate school at Stanford, I had the wonderful opportunity to meet a lot of great older writers who had done stuff. And I met several of Hitchcock's writers. And one of them that I really loved was Ernie Lehman, who wrote, of course, North by Northwest. And I began on this thing of how cool would it be to write a great thriller on the road. one of the things you learn very quickly, and Hitchcock points out a lot to Truffaut and other people, is it's better to do thrillers where you're inside a house where, you know, it's all contained and you don't know what's behind that door. It's really a chore to do it when you're on the run. And Ernie Lehman said it was the most nightmarish thing that he had ever had to do, was because Hitch would come in and say, "I have an idea, Mount Rushmore." And then he would leave, and you know, and it would be like, oh my God. And so I started thinking this is how we were going to do The Fugitive. I have an idea, Chicago. You know, it's like one of the things that I started pounding the drum from the beginning was all through it, I'm going to set these things up and we're going to pay them off down the road.
So in the script that I was looking at, the tunnel chase sequence between Gerard and Kimball.
I didn't kill my wife. I don't care.
There's a little bit more interplay, you know, between Gerard and his team going into this. And then there's that famous line, "I don't care," which has been talked about. So I was wondering if you could tell us about paring it down from kind of an original version just down to really the bare bones one-on-one conflict between the two of them, and then the importance of that, how that line ended up coming about, and then how it gets played later in the film.
Andy Davis is a former cameraman. He's a terrific director. I've done a couple of projects with him, but he sees the whole world with a lens in front of him. I mean, he does not trust the script. At least he didn't when he was working with me. Visually, he can tell a story, and he trusts only once he gets shooting. He knows how he can put these pieces together. But I was hired when I was very young to come in and completely re-edit a movie called Firebirds about helicopter pilots. And it had Sean Young and Nick Cage and Tommy Lee Jones. And it was kind of cool to be given this project. And I started to think I was pretty cool. And Nick Cage came in. We redid his lines in ADR. And then I got Sean Young, you know, to come in and do her lines. And then when they brought Tommy in, I said, by that time, I thought, you know, look at what I'm doing. This is really great. You were involved in this terrible, terrible movie and blah, blah, blah. And he asked all the people to leave the room. And then he said, "Did it ever occur to you that I might have written this terrible movie?" And I thought, oh, this is where you just, you know, I remember that old axiom, it's better to be thought a fool than to open your mouth and remove all doubt. And I just had done that. So anyway, when Tommy came on to The Fugitive, it was not, I remember meeting him in the lobby of the Four Seasons in Chicago. And Andy Davis said, "Tommy, this is Jeb. Jeb, this is Tommy." And Tommy said, "I know Jeb." Those great lines, two of my favorite lines, the Peter Pan line and the "I've got a gopher" line, are his. We ran into some trouble, however, and were lines like "I don't care." And the "I don't care" line is difficult because it's a terrible line for an actor. I had to get across to the audience that these were not FBI or sheriff's deputies or local police. These were U.S. Marshals, and I chose them as U.S. Marshals for one reason, and that's because they're after felons. I wanted Richard Kimball to have already had his day in court. He was a convicted felon. There are no Miranda rights for convicted felons. If you see this guy, you're going to shoot this guy. I mean, you might be nice if you're Tommy and say, "Stop," which he does. He even calls him by his first name, which we debated a lot about. But the whole idea of "I don't care" really gets to his character. He doesn't care. That's not his job. His job's not to, and we need to tell the audience, well, Tommy didn't want to say this line. The other reason I brought this up was that incredible set that was done on an old Westinghouse warehouse in Chicago. It probably was like 19 degrees outside, snowing like crazy, and it's unheated, and they're running around in there in water that was turning on and turned off and turned on and turned off, and they would do these things. And so we got to a point where I just happened to be on the set that day, and Tommy said, "I just don't feel the line. I don't think it's, you know, why do, you know," and I explained to him theoretically why "I don't care" was important, and he said, "It's a terrible line." And I said, "You know, I can give you that, but let's try something else." So we tried something else, and we tried something else, and tried something else, and we tried. And Harrison's a terrific counteractor. I mean, he will stand there in the wet pointing a gun at somebody while they go through lines because he's giving him his line and that sort of thing. Eventually, we got to this take, and I said, "I got an idea. Why don't we say, 'I don't care,' you know?" And he goes, "I don't care." And the director and everybody went, "Cut, print, let's do it." And Tommy said, "No, I didn't like that. Was good. We should, you know, that wasn't good." And everybody, we realized we got it. We were going to print it, and we did. And that's why it's not one of my favorite lines in the movie, but I am so proud that we got that line. And it works terrifically for the show. And Tommy will probably tell you a different story. And I can't bring up, I can't say this enough. There are parts of this movie, and Tommy was Andy's casting choice, and he had done Under Siege with him, and he was spectacular. There's no question in anybody's mind ever that he was terrific with it, because if you don't believe him when he flips up the grate and says, you know, we've got to go for it, you know he's going after this guy.
You had mentioned earlier your lesson that you learned from Hitchcock's writers of it's a lot easier to do thriller in a building. So send him back into Chicago, but there's a reason for it. And that's actually going to stir Gerard in a way that he's not just after a man. He's wondering why he's coming back. But also when you had picked this overall sequence and you had sent it to me, you had labeled it fulminators. And I was scratching my head. What? I don't know what that means. So maybe you could talk about those two points. If you want to start with fulminators first. So what does that mean for you?
I don't think fulminator is actually a term you learn in film school, but it was a term that Walter Hill told me. I was working on Another 48 Hours with him, and that was in the advent of the fax machine, which changed every writer's life because suddenly you didn't have two or three days. Suddenly this in the middle of the night, the thing would go, and this thing would come up, and Walter Hill would say, I want a scene about this, or I need a scene about that. So Walter felt that visually you needed these things called fulminators. And fulminators are guys, it's Chris and I loading bullets into our gun, okay? I mean, it's a cutaway scene where, they look like bad guys, okay? And in its highest level, which I aspire to, you're actually doing little things that are leading you towards something else. And that can be kind of crafted and put together, and if you've got a good, you know, if you got James Newton Howard to write the score, you've got a chance of really telling part of the story. And I knew we had to do part of that because back to my Warner Brothers story, I said to Warner Brothers, one of the things I want him to do is I want him to come back to Chicago. Well, at the time we were just throwing out cities and we kept throwing out Chicago as a home for this. And they were like, why would he do that? He should run for the hills. And I said, no, because he's, you know, well, He didn't kill his wife. He's trying to prove that. And they'd say, why would he be trying to do that? You know, we want him to be running from this guy. So I had to get him back to Chicago. I had to get Nichols back involved in it because he plays a big part of the MacGuffin.
So you guys went to medical school together?
Yes, we did.
The class of 73. You know Morton Feinberg?
I do.
He's a real nice guy. When'd you see him last?
Oh, Richard.
Yeah.
Okay, I saw Richard this morning.
What? You saw him this morning?
He stopped me in my car. I gave him some money.
You're kidding. Where was this?
Outside my tennis club.
Did he ask you for help?
I volunteered. He wouldn't accept that.
Well, how much money did you give him this morning?
Oh, a couple of bucks, just what I had on me.
Well, you don't get far in that.
And, you know, we needed to have these little fulminators to put it together. I need to start seeing Tommy Lynn Jones, which we didn't get to see, sort of scratch his head and say, why the hell did he come back?
Why do you think he came back to Chicago?
He didn't tell me that, sir.
No, that's not what I meant. I'm sure he's trying to protect you from having to lie for him, of course, but... Dr. Nichols, you really want to help him. You really want to be his friend. You're going to help us bring him in unharmed.
Hi. So he go back to prison?
If you want help, gentlemen, you've come to the wrong man. Richard is innocent. And you'll never find him. He's too smart.
Oh, we're three smart guys.
Yeah, what about us?
Last time I looked.
Yeah, we're smart. We are. I mean, how smart could he be, really? Is he as smart as you are?
Smarter.
It makes sense. Every U.S. Marshal will tell you 90% of, you know, escapees go back to where they feel comfortable. So it made sense for him on that level. But he's doing things. He's putting himself at risk. And so these little fulminator pieces go into that play. So
the sequence I always find really interesting because, you know, we stop in the middle of this movie of him running, you know, and trying to prove his own case. And here he is, and we get to see his character again. We mentioned this earlier in the bus, but he can't ignore his Hippocratic Oath.
You bring this kid down to observation room 2? Yeah, you. Come on, help us out, okay?
Okay.
you doing, champ? How you feeling?
My chest hurt.
Yeah? Does it hurt when you breathe?
Yes.
It's good. It's good.
What's your name?
Joel.
He can't ignore what he sees right in front of him. He just feels compelled. He has to save this kid because he knows he can intervene, and really at the risk of being caught.
Gladys, where's that boy I sat down with the janitor?
What boy?
The one with the fractured sternum.
He never came through here.
He didn't.
No, he didn't.
Hank, you have a particular interest in our patient's x-rays?
What do you mean?
I saw you looking at that boy's chest film.
It's a hobby of mine.
It's a hobby, really?
Yeah.
What are your other hobbies? Brain surgery?
What do you want?
I want to know how that boy ended up in surgery.
Look, I'm a janitor. I do what I'm told.
That's bullshit. Who changed those orders?
I don't know what you mean.
You stand right there.
Marie! Call security!
Talk to us about the importance of when you kind of stumbled on this idea of this needs to be included, because it's also really important for Gerard understanding who he's actually chasing when he discovers that Kimball actually stopped to help this boy. So when in your process did you realize this scene needed to go into the film?
Well, this is one of those cases where when you're in production, stuff happens and it makes life a lot more complicated. I knew that we needed. I always love this scene because it's when you're doing if you're doing a big action movie or you're doing a detective movie or something like that. There's always a point where you say, "Don't do that, okay? Don't expose yourself to that. You're doing so well. Why the hell would you do that?" And it's and this is one of those scenes. And for me, it's interesting because it really, since he's not an action hero, he's a doctor. This is a very natural thing for him to do, and he can't stand that this guy, he's been in hospitals, he understands that he's a vascular surgeon, he knows how it operates, how the whole system works. And we've seen that before when he was down in the North Carolina hospital, and he knew how a little hospital would work with the fellow in the bed, and he ate his food, and he did all that kind of stuff, stitched himself up. So we know he already knows his way around a hospital. What made this complicated was that we hired Julianne Moore to be a love interest, which I never wanted. In fact, that was one of the things, if you go back to the conversation in the summertime, I said, you can't have a love interest, okay? The guy's proving that he didn't kill his wife. Now we're going to have him in bed with Julianne Moore, okay? What part of that's not coming through? And, I thought that I'd won that battle, and then one day, an executive from Warner Brothers flew into Chicago and said, we've hired her. She's the greatest thing since sliced bread. You're going to put her in bed with Harrison Ford. And if you don't, you're fired. And I said, I can't. I mean, it doesn't work. I mean, I can write her a great scene. Fired. And they fired me. And there was one person who will remain nameless. She walked out of the office and sat in my room at the Four Seasons, and she went right down the hall and she met with Harrison. And then about 5 minutes later, she came back down and she said, "You're not fired." So I always liked that scene because I felt like I didn't want to look into her eyes. I thought she was spectacular in that role because for a really tiny piece, and I think she came on thinking it was a much bigger piece. She made a terrific scene out of it. It would not have been anywhere near as good without her looking him in the eye and calling and saying, stay right there. That worked really well for me. It's very apparent that I kept rope-a-doping everybody. We'd go to these production meetings and they'd say, well, we're about, 4 weeks from finishing, 3 weeks from finishing. What happens? It was like reading a Dickens serial. And I didn't know. And they really got to a point where I remember about 1 o'clock in the morning saying, you know what, tomorrow we have a meeting and I'm going to say, I don't have an end to this movie. I've spent $75 million of your money and we've shot all this stuff and you're going to have to get another writer because I've just, I don't have any idea. And I remember thinking, all right, I'm happy with that. I'll just throw myself on the sword tomorrow and I'll admit that it's been a big farce. And I turned out the light and lay down the bed, and like 10 seconds later, turned the light on. And as Faulkner says, it's the gift of the subconscious. And it was all very practical. Oh, Lentz. Lentz. You know, we've been talking about Lentz all this whole thing, and it became the joke of all jokes, because I walked in the next day and I explained how it all went, and they said, this is great. Why didn't you tell us this 2 months ago? And I said, oh, you know, it wouldn't have had the same importance if you know. Yeah. The talent that was involved in this movie, from, you know, from the actors to the cinematographers to the, you know, the editors, who were all nominated for Oscars. I mean, it, if I've done my job right, it makes everybody else elevate. And there's nothing more exciting than being in a production meeting where, you know, costume has an idea, the editors have an idea, you know, everybody feeds off of what you've done in the paper. And believe me, I steal everybody's ideas and take credit for it, but I'm not above that. But I'm glad when it works on screen, and sometimes it just, Tommy Lee Jones deserved the Oscar for this movie. He, because of the way we had to make it, where I'm serving like three different masters, you know, I'm trying to tell a story that makes sense. Okay, and we all keep our jobs. Which, by the way, no one thought we were ever going to work again. Nobody. I was over in Italy, and I got a call from Harrison Ford and Andy Davis. They did one screening of this movie in Pasadena, a secret screening to test it. And we were all convinced we would never work again. And it got the highest ratings of any Warner Brothers movie of all time. And Harrison said, I think we're going to work again. And it was a very important point, because Harrison had never done a big movie without Spielberg or Lucas that had made money. I mean, he'd done a lot of really good movies, but they didn't open. So it was very important, you know, on that point. And literally, you know my story. I didn't think I could come up with an ending to this thing. So I really didn't think it was going to work. And I think Andy was terrified. So anyway, the whole point of, You really have to have some skin in the game. You know, don't think it's somebody else's money. It was like my career. So.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment of the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Aaron Halligan, Colin Heyer, Sonia Onescu, and Maya Perez. Our production coordinator is Ava Mikes. Editing from Brian Ramos, Jamal Knox, and Madeline Burgess. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance, KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more from the Austin Film Festival and Conference each October.
PRI, Public Radio International.